This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest this week is Fred Ho, and he's quite an extraordinary man, a revolutionary activist in his youth, and I gather maybe still. Fred Ho has co-edited several books, including Afro-Asia, Revolutionary Political and Cultural Connections Between African Americans and Asian Americans, as well as Legacy to Liberation, Politics and Culture of Revolutionary Asian Pacific America. But that's just one side of Fred Ho. He's also a baritone sax player, a composer, the founder of the Afro-Asian Music Ensemble, the Monkey Orchestra, the Brooklyn Sax Quartet, and Caliente, Circle Around the Sun. Plus, he's a teacher, too. Fred Ho, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Glad to be here with you, Matt.
You know, it's always hard to summarize an individual in just a couple phrases or two, but you've done so much interesting work in your life. I want to get into that. But, you know, I know you're battling cancer right now, and I'm wondering how you're doing.
I think fairly well, given the fact that a year ago, fall of 2007, all the doctors only gave me 1 in 4 chances of living.
Oof.
So I've been given a great gift. I have to pass my colonoscopy in about 2 weeks. Knock on wood. I hope I do that. But it's been a brutal 2-year war.
What kind of cancer?
Colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. I was diagnosed August 4th of 2006, stage 3B colorectal cancer. Stage 4 is terminal. Only 8% of people who are diagnosed with stage 4 live. About 2/3 to 70% of people with stage 3A, 3B, about 2/3 don't make it.
And so, how have the treatments been?
Well, this is what I have been through. I've been through 4 surgeries, 3 chemotherapies that lasted for a total of 1 year continuously, radiation, and that's been the sum of the salt that I've had on me, plus a myriad of side effects that, and some still to be manifest that I can't even anticipate.
But you look good. Do you feel okay?
I feel generally good, though still very weak and fatigued for the most part.
Those treatments can knock you out.
I still have to rest considerably, you know. But I believe I've been gifted, and I have to rethink and begin a new life. I publicly announce when I perform, and I've just started to come back to perform again, that I'm the new Fred Ho. My predecessor, the old Fred Ho, died August 4th, 2006.
Well, tell me, who is the new Fred Ho?
The new Fred Ho is someone on a journey to eliminate all ego, to accept the truth, no matter how vituperously it's hurled at me, as long as there's a grain of it there, to accept that truth, to find that truth. The new Fred Ho is someone who wants to eliminate as much toxicity from his life as possible, both environmental and social. Someone who now has become very selective in not only what I eat, for instance, but also just who I associate with, people who are dysfunctional or, you know, bring a lot of baggage with them, people that I cannot have in my life anymore. The new Fred Ho is a Luddite, someone who is not necessarily anti-technology, but in the 19th century conception of Luddism, someone who is opposed to technology that is harmful to the common good, harmful to society, harmful to the environment, to the planet. The new Fred Ho is someone who is on a mission to do the art and the politics that no one else can or will do. I'm not interested in a career anymore. I don't need to make money. I don't need any kind of recognition or rewards. I want to do the things. I've been gifted a chance again. I want to do the things that no one will or can do in the field of arts and activism.
In the field of activism, what would that be?
Well, in the past, it's been supporting the most difficult issues like freeing U.S. political prisoners. I continued being anti-imperialist. But for the future, in terms of activism, it's really promoting what I believe would be a regeneration of socialism, a conception of it based upon matriarchy, Luddism, and what I would call a new infusion of humanism, the celebration of liberation, the imagination, of trying to evoke values in the here and now of what we think a future society must have in order for us to be just and sustainable. So my activism is really to take on those things that are just very much out of the conception of most of the left in general. Most people do not subscribe to Luddism. They in fact condemn it. They think it's a bad thing, a backward thing. But I really think that if we are to have a sustainable future and not kill the planet, we have to learn, particularly in the first world, how to live with considerably less.
And what are those things that we should live without or with less of?
Well, I think two things we need to completely eliminate. One is the internal combustion engine, and the second thing is plastics. The degradation of plastics when they enter the soil or into the water system as dioxins are lethal and toxic. The internal combustion engine is the main source, you know, of global warming. We can do without either fairly easily, I feel. It's just that we have to, you know, not see that personal immediate convenience and gratification is something that is desirable. In fact, I think we need to see that just because something can be done faster, more powerfully, or bigger does not mean it's better. And we have to have another conception of what better means.
Your conception, Fred Ho, excuse me, yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, of what better means includes the word socialism. A lot of people have given up on that term for several different reasons, one of which is that it seems like an unsellable notion here in the United States where people are so hostile to the idea. Why do you believe it's important to keep using that term?
For the simple premise that people and the planet should always be primary above profit. For that simple premise, you know, my conception of socialism is not just an economic system. It's really a social system. It's social relations. When Marx says, when he was challenged, you know, are you an economic determinist? He said, well, only if your understanding of economics is social. And really, that's how I look at it as well, that socialism, as the word social, the first part of that two-syllable word is about, is really, you know, of putting the well-being of humanity, which should not be inconsistent with the planet, as primary. That the sanctity of profit is something that we need to discard. We have the capacity to satisfy all human needs. The problem is that there are a lot of false needs and wrong needs, you know, promoted by a system of commodity production and exchange that wants to basically, you know, get people to consume, buy, and have a passive relationship to production, you know, either as passive workers, laborers, or as passive consumers, you know, and I think that that is the contradiction that is leading to the collapse. And I believe we are really well on the wage of a collapse. I think we can see the collapse much more globally in terms of its disaster in the third world, which is the majority of the world, but it's now coming to the first world, you know, and this economic crisis that the United States and many other first world countries are facing is just a prelude to even greater disasters, of which the environment will probably be the ultimate one.
It's certainly an overconsumption crisis right now, and the environment will suffocate from that, too. I'm talking with Fred Ho. He's this Asian-American activist and musician who has been doing political work and cultural work for four decades now, I guess. You talked about a socialism that was matriarchal, is that correct, or maternal, or what was the word there?
Matriarchal.
Why that?
Because the opposite of patriarchy is matriarchy. You know, if the problem has been stratification, class division of society, you know, militaristic states, patriarchy, if we look at the entire spectrum of human society, both globally as well as over a longer span of time than, let's say, 2, 3, 4 millennium even, but the entire scope of human existence from about 1 to 2, 3, 4 million years ago, we understand, and no cultural anthropologist would deny this, that the bulk of human history has been matriarchal. And it only makes sense in the sense that the center of, well, women produce 100% of the world's children. You know, they do about 60%, 70% of the world's work, grow about 60% of the world's food, earn about 10% of the world's income, and own less than 1% of the world's property. If that's the triangle, the hierarchical triangle, what is its opposite? Its opposite, you know, will be a transitional period called matriarchy, in which women will, you know, in the classic definition of the rightful return to the producers, their position in society that would equate with what they produce. So that to me is matriarchy. That would also mean a very different kind of quote-unquote state. It would mean a demilitarized military, a matriarchal army, for instance, would function very differently than a patriarchal army because it's not preserving and protecting the power and the rights of those who do little work. You know, it is actually ensuring the rightful returns of those who do most of the work, which is justice. So that's kind of my conception of matriarchy. In fact, I have a long essay called Matriarchy, the First and Final Communism, that's coming out in a new book of mine called Wicked Theory, Naked Practice, the Fred Ho Reiner by the University of Minnesota Press next April of 2009.
Wicked Theory, Naked Practice, great title too. How did you come about your politics?
I would say, you know, typically of most people through oppression, growing up, facing both a lot of racist harassment and violence, being Asian American in a predominantly white community in New England, in Western Massachusetts. And then combined with that, domestic violence, patriarchal violence from my father.
Your dad beat your mama?
And all the kids as well. Mm-hmm. My understanding that he was very accomplished in what he did, but was extremely faced a lot of discrimination. For example, he was the least paid in his field, even though he's the most published as a professor. Even his own students would ridicule him because he spoke with an accent. That kind of humiliation. And rather than fight that, he internalized it and would take it out on us at home. You know, and I've been very aware of that, you know, what I would see as the vicious cycle syndrome. And so I broke with it very young. I mean, I became a militant, but not someone who fought those who were weaker than myself, but fought those who were stronger. And that still remains my criteria. You know, if I'm going to fight someone, you know, or some forces, they would have to be, you know, as I put it, worthy from the point of view of superior force and position and power in society. But he didn't do that. And you see that syndrome among oppressed peoples often, you know, the internalization, self-hatred, self-destruction, those tendencies. And I became very aware of them quite young, the effects of oppression, even in terms of my own self-hatred, trying to part my hair on the side and make it become wavy, which never could happen. Unhappiness with how, you know, I looked, just things that could never be changed, you know. And I realized really through the teachings of Malcolm X that I was the victim, you know, and to understand power and oppression in society, you know. And I guess since that time, at about age 14, I've been on this trek to really understand the root sources of oppression and exploitation and to eliminate those sources.
I'm speaking with Fred Ho. What are some of those root sources?
Well, I think that they're not individuals, and they're not so-called human nature things like aggression or males being innately wanting to be, you know, superior and dominating and so forth. They're really rooted in the socioeconomic systems that humans have built, but particular types of systems that privilege and empower the few who must maintain their privilege and power because they want to own and control and dominate everything. So therefore, they create things like armies. They create things like institutions that glorify them, that propagate their views and values and worldview. They create all forms of both micro and macro forces that glorify, preserve, perpetuate, and prolong their supremacy.
One way they prolong their supremacy, the classic in the United States, has been racism of all varieties. One aspect of racism that you've worked a lot on, Fred Ho, is the tension between the African-American community and the Asian-American community. What are some of the tensions there, and how's that work going?
Well, the tensions are artificially created. They're created by the dominant society, in this case in the United States, white settler colonial society, in order to keep the oppressed divided and obfuscated, to be unclear about what their real struggle is or their real interests. And the interest of all oppressed people is to unite and to assert themselves for power, self-determination, and control over their destiny. In the particular case of African Americans and Asian Americans, they share a very common history, in many cases that either intersect or overlap, and consequently a common struggle. For example, plantation societies. When slavery was on the outs in early 19th century Americas, and we're talking about the Caribbean and Central South America, it doesn't finally get officially abolished until the mid-19th century in the United States. But, you know, in terms of replacing enslaved African labor, Asian labor was brought in. Just was not called slavery anymore. But in many ways, in actual experience, it was just the same. You know, families torn apart, people's limbs dismembered, you know, for opposition or, you know, just recalcitrance. You know, the brutality of the labor and so forth. Only in name was it different. In actual form and experience, it was virtually identical. So we have that experience. And then I think we have throughout the 20th century areas in which African Americans, areas, for example, in which whites abandoned or did not want to work in the most menial jobs, they went to either African Americans or Asian Americans. So we have many historical examples like that, and we also have examples replete with solidarity and unity collaboration in which African Americans and Asian Americans united or took mutual inspiration from one another, you know, to better understand their conditions, you know, to help make a comparative analysis of their mutual situations and to, you know, take mutual inspiration you know, to develop and innovate new forms of struggle. And that's what my book, Afro-Asia, is really about. It's really about those common histories and those solidarities in which collaboration, innovation, and solidarity were key.
Give me one example of one of those key collaborations.
Well, during the 1960s, for example, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which was one of the avatar left groups in America, inspired many, many social movements, you know, and just emblazed the consciousness around the world. You know, things like slogans, all power to the people, the raised fist, you know, the symbols of Black pride, the Afro, you know, even Black people bearing guns, all of that. I mean, you know, there were three founders of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in Oakland. Two are very well known, the two African-Americans, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. But the third is virtually unknown, and that was Richard Aoki, a Japanese-American who actually schooled both Huey and Bobby in socialism and Marxism, armed them, got them their first guns, introduced them to Mao's Red Book. Another example, in terms of an Asian-American presence in the Black Liberation Movement, is a woman by the name of Yuri Kochiyama, who lived in Harlem from the 50s. And you don't see this in that atrocious movie by Spike Lee, Malcolm X, because he fictionalizes this. But when Malcolm was assassinated at the Audubon Ballroom, Malcolm was lying on the floor bleeding, and his head was in the lap of this Japanese-American woman, Yuri Kochiyama. Not Betty Shabazz, as Spike Lee depicts it. Yuri Kochiyama became one of the major people, I guess, in the support work of the Black Liberation Movement, both its above ground and as well as its underground operations. The Black Liberation Movement as a whole, the Panthers, Malcolm X, galvanized and inspired and catalyzed the contemporary Asian American movement. A lot of the things that we understand, even in the term when we call ourselves Asian Americans and not Orientals, for instance, was parallel to African Americans no longer calling themselves Negroes. Negro was a term, Portuguese term, colonial term applied to those people of dark skin from Africa. Similarly, the term Oriental was a term applied to those people east. East of what? East of Europe. You know, when we're talking about Iran, Iraq, all the way to, you know, the Okinawan Islands off of Japan. So that whole monolith called the East became Oriental.
Yeah, East depends on where you're standing.
Right. East of what? East of the Mississippi?
Say, I can't let you get away with explaining why you thought that movie was atrocious, the Spike Lee movie on right. Malcolm X. Why was it atrocious other than that one scene?
Well, because basically it did not depict Malcolm as a revolutionary. You know, I don't mind fictionalizing particular historical details. I mean, you know, I'm an artist myself. I grant artistic license. But you have to, if you're doing some kind of a piece based on historical reality, at least grasp the essence of it properly, correctly. So the essence of Malcolm X was that he was a revolutionary. He certainly evolved. His thinking never stayed static, you know, but you have to convey that. And the movie doesn't. You know, he's seen as a grassroots community organizer and so forth. But that really does not capture the essence of Malcolm X that made him such an important and great historical figure, one of the great historical figures of the 20th century.
I'm speaking with Fred Ho. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Tell me a little bit about your music, because we haven't talked about that. And I know you're a musician, you're a composer, you're the founder of several ensembles. And you say you want to push the music as you've pushed your politics into places that no one else is going. So what direction are you moving your music into?
I'm trying to, on two levels, both aesthetical and then I would say, you know, I guess, I don't know what the term would be, but I would say, I guess, in the social process of music making, on two levels. Let me first start with the aesthetical. I'm trying to develop a music that pays homage and evokes, you know, both, I would say, pre-modern, modern, and quote-unquote postmodern influences, all simultaneously, in the sense that I do not feel that Western European bourgeois classical music is the apex of music. It's not the end of musical history, just as I don't feel that capitalist ideology is the end of history either. And I believe that a lot of traditional influences and sources offer still a lot of humanizing liberatory potential, just as I feel like simpler, earlier, so-called primitive lifestyles probably offer us today a way of life that's probably much better. You know, I realize we cannot go back to the past nor worship it blindly. I'm not an atavist, but I believe those sources are important to understand. But I also realize they were crushed and destroyed by colonialism. You know, so we cannot just worship them blindly. So we need to come up with something new. And I feel that what that newness involves is understanding that music as a human expression. I mean, I have not yet been persuaded that birds make music or whales make music or wolves make music, but as a human expression, that we need to find a way in which the music, you know, can more instrumentally liberate humanity. And I'll give you one example, one simple example that's not too technical. Today we have all these fancy computers and machines that at a press of a button can create very exciting and different kinds of sounds. But if you're going to do that on your saxophone, it may take you 30 years. But here's the difference. It may be the same sound, but that 30-year journey you have done to get there has not only changed you, it's changed your instrument, and it's changed even how we hear that sound. So that is the humanness that is lost when we become, when we fetishize and become obsessed with speed, quickness, novelty, machinery, and so forth. Saxophones, they're still tools. They're still a form of technology. But we understand that the human technology, because the saxophone won't play itself, the human application, both in terms of breath, embouchure, philosophy, mental conception, imagination, that technology is a technology that we need to enhance more of. Then on the process, social process, I feel the ensembles of the future need to become telepathic, that we need to enhance our capacity as human beings to intuit and sense and understand each other on a level that's almost like telepathy, where we can make the whole greater than the sum of its parts. This is not a top-down thing where the leader commands everything and everyone follows, the difference between a leader versus a side person. This is true ensemble making. That's why I call my band the Afro-Asian Music Ensemble. It's that dialectical communal process. When so-called jazz during the 20th century developed, it was excluded from the academy, from institutions of higher learning and valorization. That made the music a communal art form, similar to so-called folk music, where people passed it on through the oral tradition from older musicians sharing with younger musicians and so forth. Those traditions give certain kind of meaning to how the music evolved that we lose now when it's codified and canonized. It's taught through the university system, through the master, the professor to the students and so forth. It becomes much more regurgitative. So we have a music now where young musicians, technically brilliant, but devoid of imagination. And that's some way a metaphor for our hyper-technological society, you know.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Fred Ho, fascinating conversation on politics and music. Fred Ho is a lifetime Asian-American activist and musician, founder of the Afro-Asia Music Ensemble. Thanks so much, Fred.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.